Welcome. You're listening to the podcast where we interview founders innovating at the near frontier, whose companies will give you a glimpse of the future. Near Frontier is brought to you by Cantos, a venture firm that invests in world-positive deep tech startups at pre-seed and seed. To learn more, visit us at cantos.vc.
I'm Ian Roundtree, founder and managing partner of Cantos Ventures and host of Near Frontier. Today, we're talking to Roman Tezliuk of Earth AI. I'm really excited for this conversation and a little worried, honestly, because we really, really need the metals that underpin the energy transition right now. And looking at the data, you can see that extraction of these metals in the mining industry, in addition to having environmental impact, is declining and has been for years. If we don't invest in making metals extraction more efficient and with a lower environmental footprint, the whole energy transition could come to a screeching halt. I'm really, really concerned about this. And it's one of the reasons that I was so excited to invest in Earth AI when I first met Roman a few years ago. Let's go talk to him about how important this whole transition is and why what he's doing is key. One note before we begin the conversation, Roman was actually in the office for this. And so we did it in person and had not planned or taken notes. So we're going to see how this goes. It's a bit more casual than most of our episodes. But Roman, for the audience's benefit, I gave a little background for them earlier, but why don't you tell us a little about Earth AI and how it came to be? You want to tell the mining to academia to startup story?
Well, I'll try to give like a quick overview of the past, but you know, stop me if I'm going for too long. So I'm Roman Tezliuk. I'm a geologist from Ukraine. Originally, I picked geology because I love exploring nature and going to one of the most remote sites in the world. But similarly, I like scientific research and building new technologies to solve practical problems. And so I spent a couple of years exploring after I graduated in Kyrgyzstan and Tianjin and like Arctic Russia, then Far East. And I loved the part of my job where I was exploring the really cool remote places, but I also wanted to felt like hungry with my mind to go and dive deep into research and improve the ways mineral deposits are found. I moved to Australia to do a PhD in University of Sydney. Then spent a couple of years working with data and classifying rocks using geochemical data. And it's an interesting story I like to tell about my project.
Please
research
do.
Project.
By all means.
So before planets were formed, the universe was full of chondrite meteorites. They have kind of uniform content, you know, or uniform metal composition. And then when they started to kind of stick to each other and some impacts make them melt and form planets, the matter started differentiating. And, you know, the Earth is made of Earth's crust, mantle, and core in cross-section. So the mantle is where the matter differentiation happens, and all the heavy elements, they sink down to the core. On the light elements, they rise up in form of spreading ridges like Iceland, just like big crack across the ocean where magma erupts and intrudes and solidifies, forming new oceanic crust. Or similarly, like Hawaii, which is like an extremely hot mantle plume that comes up, erupts, and forms these islands in the middle of the ocean. These type of like fractionate melts from the mantle, they're very extremely enriched in trace elements. And in geology, we work with rocks that are like, could be recent, could be...
What's recent?
Well, recent could be like Iceland. Right.
Okay. Well, I don't know. What is that?
Iceland is, you know, like eruptions happening right now. New baby rocks are born every day. And then, you know, what my rocks from my research were 2.4 billion years old. And, you know, the oldest rock we know about on Earth is 4 billion years old. So across the history of the Earth, there's so many rocks, you know, that have been formed. And by analyzing the trace element contents, you can understand what were the geological processes that led to their formation. So it's either these spreading ridges like Iceland or Hawaii, or, you know, once it sort of gets older and the crust pushes away into towards from the spreading ridge towards the continents, they sink, and then they remelt and form these either like Andes or convective margins. Or Japan, that's where the old oceanic crust sinks down, remelts, and that's reflected in the trace element contents as well. So they have like you can see that early enrichment trend, but you also see depletion because it got melted again.
So what's like the element breakdown? I don't know, what would you find in Japan versus Iceland?
In this sense, this is different levels of like rare earth elements. The whole point there is like it's not for like finding ways to extract it, but more like, especially that research project was more like how we can understand the rock from the chemical contents that it's made of. The current way that people do this is more like small scale graphical data plots and some qualitative and mix of qualitative and quantitative data.
Where are those data sets coming from?
Well, you literally go to the outcrop, pick up the rock, and analyze it.
Like with mass spec or something?
Yeah. You crush it, homogenize it, and then send it to the lab to get the ICP-MS.
So you're at University of
Sydney.
Yeah. Doing this, taking samples and analyzing it.
Yeah. And then trying to interpret what they mean. And what I learned is that there isn't a clear data-driven way of classifying these rocks. The way to do it, the way it's done right now is more like qualitative, what people called it before, and like some other textural properties of the rock. And, you know, basically a lot of it comes from the kind of bulk of historical knowledge of how it's been discovered, what people told about it before. This is good, but the physics behind the theory of like how the magma melts and how these trace elements are formed is fundamentally correct. So therefore, there should be a way to build a data-driven classification of these rocks just based on the data. And it should be working well. But this haven't been done before. So what I did is I thought, well, I can't find the actual difference between the current way the rocks are classified. I need to go and build that model that will classify the rocks using the data.
Spoiler alert, you don't finish your PhD. What sort of was the impetus to leave the study and ultimately start a company?
Yeah, so what I didn't find that was working for me being a researcher is that you get to invent a new technology and publish a paper, and that's basically the end of your work. So you don't really see the impact it creates. And you don't really have enough control over will it actually create impact or how it's going to change the world. And what I wanted is to not just invent, but also make the change and change the world for the better. So I thought, this is lovely, but starting a tech company that's working on fundamentally new technologies for mineral exploration will be much better suited for me and will actually create actionable impact on the industry and improve our chances of finding metal deposits that we so incredibly need right now for the renewable energy transition.
Yeah, understatement. So before we get into like the pending crisis, like in your academic work, you were working on some of like the rare earth elements, the heavier elements, and today Earth AI focuses on more of like the I guess more common technology metals. So what was that transition like, moving up the periodic table in a way? Was that like purely a commercial like impact calculus?
I think we still do work with rare earth elements. However, it's like it's not these deposits where rare earth elements are in high. So let's put it this way. In my research work, the contents of rare earth elements that we used were minuscule. You know, to make the deposit economic, you need, you know, order 10, like maybe two order of magnitude more concentrations of these elements to make it economic to mine them.
And what elements are we talking about? Like, I mean, you
talking about just the rare earth.
Right, rare earth.
Yeah. And also, it's a the metals we need them, but we need a lot of other metals. And when we started building, you know, started looking at, so what we need to build that, we needed to build our technology is these decades and terabytes of old exploration data that we can build an AI system to learn from. And there is, once we started building it, there was a lot of data about everything, and the method to process it and clean up that data is similar for every element. So we thought that's, there's no point for us to specialize in one if literally by, you know, running the process over all elements, we can get the database of everything. And in the industry, even in mineral exploration, there's commonly an issue with focusing only on one commodity and not analyzing for others and missing deposits that are right next door because you're only looking for copper, but there might be a lithium deposit.
Is that because like the companies are siloed by atomic number? It's like you're a gold company, you're a copper company, and there could be nickel right next door, but you don't see it because you're not looking
for it.
That's
right. A lot of the value of the mineral exploration company is that they're valued on just the fundamentals of how good their ore body is, like how big it is, what's its grade, but also what the current market dynamics for that particular commodity. And if say copper price goes up, the value of copper exploration companies go up as well. I met recently a silver exploration company, and they said like their value basically is heavily speculated on the current price.
Totally. I mean, it is true that mineral exploration has been so financialized because there's a copper ETF, a gold ETF, a silver ETF, a palladium and platinum are usually coupled together in financial assets. And the like physical implementation of that financialization is something that I think if you're just trading commodities, maybe you're not thinking about. Can you give us like a synopsis on how the industry works today? Like how is it broken down from by metal, sort of the vertical stack of how we get metals out of the ground? And then does it differ by geography?
Yeah, let's start from the top. So you trade commodities, right? And ETFs, I guess, you know, it's like you're not actually physically moving them. Like one step down is commodity trading companies who will buy commodities, buy the mining output and sell it to users. And they could buy bulk or sign these contracts where they kind of pre-buy it, offtake contracts. They pre-buy mine, part of mine production for several years, even before the mine is built. Before that, I would say, before we jump into like the mining company to the production, there are royalty companies that have a specific type of license over the mine, which entitles them to receive a couple of percent of the mine revenue, or so it's royalty and streams.
Is that because they bought part of the offtake or something and then they turn around and sell it to somebody else?
No, they can buy that royalty at any time before the project could be completely like a site where no work has been done or during the development. The most typical time when the royalty companies buy in is before the mine construction, during the final stages of feasibility. And that helps finance the project construction. And for the royalty company, it secures their payback over, you know, two decades or something, an average mine life is. Yeah, so the royalty companies, there's royalty companies that take a couple of percent of the revenue. And there's also stream companies that buy a particular metal, just the concentrate of the metal. So there's like, you can have a polymetallic mine produces copper, gold, and silver. A silver streaming company can buy all the silver produced from that mine and, in fact, from that region and then, like, bulk it up and sell it at a better price.
It's less common on the American stock exchanges, but on, like, the Toronto Stock Exchange or the Australian Stock Exchange, you have all these publicly traded companies that have, like, I don't know, billion-dollar market caps sometimes, but they're, like, five people. Are those the royalty companies?
Yeah, there's like, for example, like there's the royalties is like a very lucrative business model because you have pre-booked revenue with mortgage over it. You are guaranteed to receive the money and you're not liable for any Like you don't have any operational involvement in that project. You have a license over the land. And like Franco-Nevada, for example, have like a market cap of like $40 billion, right? While having just a couple of dozen employees and just massive royalty portfolio. And, you know, their main business is, you know, securing the growth of the portfolio, investing in new projects while just receiving these steady revenues from their mines.
So how's Earth AI going to get a cut of that? That seems like a pretty good gig.
Yeah, it is. Well, yeah. So our business model is a royalty generator. So we're actually bringing the two end members of the industry. So we are going down to the furthest sort of earliest stage of exploration, the greenfield setting, where areas that have never been explored before, there's maybe some sparse samples, but usually nothing. And we're partnering with conventional exploration companies that own that land, and they're publicly traded, and they just usually publicly traded explorers, they have like 5 licenses on average.
What's the difference between an explorer and a, like a royalty company?
So there's, between those two, there's mining companies that focus on mining the ore of the deposit and, you know, selling it to the commodity traders. And exploration companies, they're like they're mining startups, basically. They have a project that they're developing, and they're valued on the discounted price of the future mine. So at the moment, you know, they might be still in development, but, you know, this mine, if put into production, will be a, you know, $5 billion mine. But because there are risks in development and approvals and, you know, continuity of the ore, that's why that they're worth roughly at 5% of the value of metal in their ore body.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's like a rule of thumb, basically. And so where we come in is we're before them, or like help them with the earliest part of the discovery.
Was there a point in coming up with the concept of the company where you thought maybe you could just sell the leads and like just be a software company?
Yeah, in 2017 we were doing, yeah, we'd be an exploration SaaS company. It's going to be great, massively scalable. And, you know, we gave it a, you know, we ran a very big campaign on it. We had 80 pilots with explorers and miners, and so made some money on the consulting side and on this recurring subscription. The problem is that it's not the full solution. You need that scalable field work and scalable geology and scalable drilling, because it's just not enough to know where the ore is. You need to literally do a biopsy. So mineral exploration is like finding a pimple on the skin that's like, it looks red, probably some copper there. But then before it's worth, you know, tens of millions of dollars, you have to drill it, which is basically like taking a biopsy, looking what's inside, measuring how much copper is there.
And then you can turn around and sell that for more.
Yeah.
Or you get like more of the royalty, if that's the model.
Yeah. So, you know, as it starts with a conventional exploration model is, you know, the market doesn't value, the public, you know, the market doesn't really value as much what's before drilling, because drilling is like a three-dimensional sample. You know the orientation of the ore body, you know, you cannot guess how profitable that mine's going to be.
And to clarify, when you say drilling, that is exploration versus mining, which is actually extraction.
Yeah, drilling is like drilling a small hole to test, like get a sample to see how big that ore body is. How big can the mine be? Mining and literally like excavating the rock and crushing it, putting it through the processing plant and separating the valuable metals from the host rock.
So by the time we met, which is when you were in Y Combinator and Brad Flora, who's now a full-time partner at YC, introduced us, you had recently had the realization that you weren't just going to be a SaaS company. Tell us about YYC. What was that experience like? And then we can get into what you're actually doing today.
Yeah, so we got into YC actually when we were starting to tackle the engineering problem of building a better drilling hardware set. So we already made that pivot into being vertically integrated up till discovery. And yeah, when we were doing YC, we were really hands-on on building the drilling hardware. YC was really, really good. I'd say the biggest value is in the community, just the people you meet there that are within with your group. They're in your group that, you know, you end up becoming friends with. It's just incredibly valuable to have this, you know, amount of people that on the same journey that you can learn from and, you know, support each other. Demo Day is fabulous as well. it was really good. I mean, you meet so many investors in such a structured process. They really help you a lot. They really help you a lot. It helps you a lot with finding or raising your next round, but also the partners help you during the 3-month program. They help you think right about your business, see the opportunity correctly, and also communicate effectively.
Yeah, we met. I still remember it. You came here like the Friday before Demo Day or the Thursday before Demo Day. And like over the weekend, I was like, all right, I'm in. One of the things that was sort of interesting in the seed round is talking to some other investors, I very much saw, like you did, that Earth AI is a climate tech company. But some people were like, oh, they're mining. Doesn't have a negative climate impact. And I was like, where do you think your batteries come from? Like, where do you think all of the electronic metals come from? We don't get an energy transition if we don't pull metals out of the ground. And the whole thing probably comes to a screeching halt if we don't invest in technologies like that Earth AI is building, because just as demand is spiking for everything that's in your electronics and batteries and solar panels and wind turbines, the efficiency of the industry is in decline. Like the whole thing, the whole party stops if we don't accelerate efficiency in extraction. And I know you've done a lot of work around minimizing the environmental impact too. So anyway, I'll get off my soapbox, but like, could you give us a little more on the crisis here and the opportunity from like an impact perspective?
Yeah. Well, we need to over the next couple of decades, we need to basically 5 to 10x our production of critical metals. The world we live in right now has been largely built from wood and concrete and plastic and like hydrocarbons. But all of these are finite resources and they're not renewable. And really like finite materials. But then I did like a deep dive of like actually thinking why what do we need to do? And what is the actual like issue fundamentally? And it all comes down really to renewable materials and renewable energy. Even if like every product that we use, about 10-15% of the cost of making it across the whole supply chain is materials, about 60% of the cost is the energy. So energy is really, really have like a massive impact on the cost of making anything. And our energy comes right now from hydrocarbons. And they're not a renewable source that contaminates the environment. And, you know, eventually we're going to run out of it. And it's going to just get more and more expensive. Look what happens right now when part of the supply chain, you know, you can't basically don't want to buy from them. The whole market just becomes like everything becomes so expensive. And, you know, the end consumer is actually paying the price for it, because it all gets, you know, leveraged to the normal person that actually has to pay, you know, almost twice higher gas price. And that populates into every product. So what we need to do to lower that is to use renewable energy, which is basically free from, you know, the sun. But to build these generators and infrastructure, you need these critical, what we call critical metals, lithium, nickel, cobalt, copper, rare earths, like basically all the metals that we're mining right now, except like bulks, except iron and we still need a lot of aluminium. So it's really hard to make exceptions.
Aluminum and iron are called bulks.
Yeah, because
metals.
Yeah,
there's copper in that camp too.
No, copper is base metals. Yeah, so because I guess bulks because their deposits are more bulk.
So we need a lot more of these, but the whole industry has sort of like picked the lowest hanging fruit. And so their efficiency is coming down. You help me understand.
Yeah. So to mine something, you need to find a naturally occurring high, like maybe like 1,000 times higher concentration than a normal rock. And that needs to be naturally occurring coherent body that's orientated in the right way that you can extract that metal, extract that rock, and extract the metal from that rock.
And initially it was probably like literally part of it was sticking out of the ground. We're like, oh, that's shiny. Let's dig that up.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Copper minerals, they have these green and blues of like, you know, the malachite is a sign of a copper deposit.
Mm.
So copper phosphate. So initially we could just walk up, like map the areas, look at them, find the minerals, find the right settings. It was pretty obvious. Over time, all the surface deposits have been found. Then all the shallow deposits have been found. And now we're looking for like much deeper at the depths of around 1,000 feet underground. There's not really good methods of surveying in that depths. We're trying to detect some signs on the surface that there's a deposit underneath in much lower concentrations. So, for example, like the prospects that we find, they're not like pure copper sticking out or like native copper or something that you could stumble upon before. They're more like elevated copper levels in the soil, but visually, it looks the same. Visually, it looks like a normal soil. So these are much, much harder to detect in normal methods. But when you use the satellite data, you know, with spectrometry, you can see through, you can detect the right minerals that will lead to a copper deposit.
When did the industry start using satellite data?
The industry uses satellite data, but I'd say in a simplistic way, which hasn't been adopted by the explorers.
So you're like one of the first companies to start really.
Yeah, because like the way it's used right now is by applying lab measured mineral filters to the data. For example, you measure a mineral called muscovite. You measure muscovite spectrum in the lab, and then you apply that filter to every single pixel on the remote sensing data, and where the pattern, the sort of the spectral pattern matches that of muscovite, you basically rate it how each pixel matches to it. And where the match is higher, it's going to be this. But the problem is the data is pretty like mixed up, and to mix that, it's like really hard. So these methods works only if you have a pure muscovite outcropping. You know, if it's much harder when it's a mix of minerals, which is most like I guess most cases you have like a mix of minerals. There's like soil signatures, rock signatures, vegetation signatures in that data.
So you get some like initial clue from the satellite data, which most people are not even using today, but it's only an initial hint because then you actually have to go out and maybe do a magnetic survey.
Yeah, yeah. So our AI system, it's because it has such a large training database, it can like differentiate and analyze, interpret that spectral signature much better because it's seen so much data over existing copper deposits that it can really well like pick those spectral signatures that relate to these copper deposits and you know then rate the probability like the prospectivity of that. And then after that we send a team to validate. Send a team of geologists to go and collect soil samples, rock samples, the mineralogy.
How do you get like at what point do you apply for the mineral rights?
When we partner with the explorer, they already have the mineral rights.
Mm-hmm.
So we just once we sign the agreement with them, we have you know legal like access to that land. Obviously, there is the landowners that like usually exploration happens in pastoral land. The farmers, we have to sign land access agreements with them. Typically, explorers already have these agreements, but sometimes we have to like re-engage with these areas that they hold the license but don't have the agreement yet. Sometimes we have to talk to the indigenous population as well because they're a party to that whole process. Once we sign the agreement, then we go and you know send our team to to map out the areas.
So you might have some exploration company that has the rights on a large swath of land, but they're not totally sure exactly where.
All exploration companies have a lot of land.
So it's not like you're looking at the entire globe and you're like, let's see what the best place to go is. You have some initial guidance via a partner.
Yeah. We do analysis over the whole continent, yes. But then...
And you mean Australia, which is where you started.
Yeah. Like right now, we're still focused on Australia. Uh-huh. Yeah. We did some analysis in the U.S., but we're still focused on Australia.
Yeah.
But we do know the prospective places that we want. And then just the matter of whether the explorer that we want to partner with, we can get them to sign the agreement, basically partner up with us.
And then when you tell us about this drill you built.
Yeah, the drill is a big deal. It's about 14 units of equipment that helps you drill in a minimum invasive way. So typically you need to use bulldozers to create these mud pools for the mud system to clear the cuttings. And it's the explorer's responsibility to prepare the sites for the drilling company to come in and drill. And then also you need to manage the waste. After the drilling has been done, you have to use a cleaning company to come in and kind of manage, take out the waste and dispose of it properly. What we built is a set of above ground equipment that removes the need for any groundwork, so we don't need to dig any pools. It's like a series of tanks that get connected, plugged in together, and the mud just circulates and cleans up inside them. And also, it's a full, not just waste, it's just like mud circulation system, but it's also waste removal. So we have equipment and pumps that we can clean up those tanks, put them in the waste bags, and then drive them off using our truck.
You're like a leave no trace drilling.
Yeah, exactly. That's 100% true. Moreover, other parts of the drilling equipment that we build, they really optimize the mobility, streamline the mobility and uptime of the operation, which saves the cost and makes the drilling much more scalable. There's a special, so you use rods to drill down to it. Depths, you screwed up.
How deep are you going usually?
About 1,500 feet.
Okay.
And yeah, so with this big skid to store all these rods, that's much more simple, requires less maintenance, but also can store much more rods and much bigger water tank, a mobile warehouse it's like a two mirror image, Harry Potter, the mirror cabinets. The same like the mobile warehouse. You know the mirror cabinet?
Yeah.
They transported the thing.
So that's funny.
Yeah. So we have the mobile warehouse. So
what's the capital intensity of your prospecting versus how the status quo does it?
Yeah. So our operational cost is twice cheaper. We're four times faster. And our CapEx is still 10-20% lower compared to the industry.
Wow.
And it's just a one-step process. We operate our equipment ourselves, and there's no need for any external contractors. We do our cleaning. We don't actually require any groundworks.
And so the Earth AI business model is basically you partner with some sort of bigger exploration company to come in, figure out where to actually mine or whether to mine, and then you get a cut of the royalties.
Yeah, so we partner with them over their land package, and we help them find new deposits there. So we run through our process, we target the sites, we do the geological sampling and mapping, we do the drilling, and once we hit these qualifying intersections, and there's really two cases there. One is it's a narrow high-grade ore body, or it's a large low-grade deposit. Narrow high-grade ore body could be something that could be monetized and mined out within the next, 2-3 years and maybe make up to $1 billion in revenue. And then the large, big one will take, 4 years to develop and build, but then it will run for 20, 30 years, generate $30 to $40 billion of revenue and maybe $4 billion of profit.
Wow.
Yeah, it's an average what a big mine makes.
And so you go around, you help with exploration, you get a little cut of the revenue, the revenue, not the profit, for all of these sort of like long dated revenue streams. It's a little bit funny for a startup because it's like, in a way, it's almost more like, I know some of these financialized assets like music royalties or pharmaceutical royalties. And in the long run, it can be an extremely profitable business. But you're telling me that it's like you're doing all this work up front and then it's sort of the revenue is backloaded, right? Has that been something that's difficult for some venture investors to overcome?
Yeah, certainly not for everyone, because there's a very pragmatic scientific approach into building this fully vertically integrated system, but also very long payback cycle. So certainly not for everyone.
And I want to clarify, like, of course, all startups are sort of like long payback cycles, but what I'm trying to express is that your opportunity is a little unique in that there's like this lag between the work and the revenue. Setting aside the opportunity for you and your partners to maybe sell the royalties up front, like there are some cases where you could front load the revenue, but like the real opportunity is holding on to the royalties and just waiting long enough for like someone else to do work to actually pull the metal out of the ground, at which point that's when you get your payday. It's almost, for people who do invest in computational drug discovery, I tell them that Earth AI is AI drug discovery for metals. It's like very analogous, because you're developing your own portfolio of assets that you're probably going to wait for someone else to like really bring to market. And that's when you get paid. And there's a lot of investors nowadays that are sort of the quote unquote tech bio investors that do invest in AI drug discovery, but it's not like there's a ton of AI metals discovery companies out there. And you have gotten a lot of interest from venture investors, but there's been times where I've thought like, I don't know, you should like raise your own hedge fund or something.
That sounds like a great idea. Yeah. I think, you know, later down the track when we have a couple of royalties, we definitely should think of partnering with a royalty company to build like an operational fund to cover the operational cost of running it. You know, if you look big picture at the industry, but somebody has to do it. Somebody has to find new deposits. Traditional methods have been declining success rates. And like the success rate right now is 1 in 200, 0.5% from picking a site to building a mine.
Wow. It really is like drug discovery.
But we need to 5 to 10x the production of metals. So somebody has to find these deposits in an efficient way, in a scalable way. I would say even more importantly, in this scalable way, because when success rates are so low, you want to be very, very scalable to succeed. And that's sort of where our strategic choices have been made, is we can generate predict locations at scale. We have like thousands of pre-validated targets we want to explore. We are very cost conscious with the lowest operating costs in the industry, because we run our own equipment that's new generation drilling equipment. And the combination of two, high prediction and low cost of targeting, gives us massive potential in terms of finding many, many, many deposits.
So can you, despite the dramatic opportunity here, there are only a handful of startups that are really applying machine learning to mining, and maybe the best funded is Cobold Metals. There's another YC company, Stratum AI. I know you're close with the founder. Could you tell us what they do juxtaposed to Earth AI?
Yeah, so Cobold, yeah, really great company. They built a different kind of way of technology to detect deposits. They having a different sort of, they picked a different strategy approach to us. They're approaching, I guess they're going all the way through to building the mine, and you know, obviously
themselves,
yeah.
That's why they raised so much money.
Yeah, they raised so much money because basically they're not just stopping at a discovery; they're going all the way through feasibility, signing typical joint ventures, industry joint ventures, using drilling contractors, paying market rates, for the drilling work.
And for the audience's benefit, they've raised like over $200 million.
Yeah. They just recently raised $192 million in February.
Wow.
Yeah. And they're really good. Like they have Andreessen Horowitz invested in them and Bill Gates. Yes. BHP invested. Yeah, that's right. They've been really good at that strategic approach where.
But they're taking on more of the capital risk.
Yeah, it's much higher capital risk because even after you find a deposit, there is, you know, only 15% success chance that it's going to be big enough and rich enough to become a mine. And that means you need 120 to 240 million to run six prospects through feasibility.
Okay, I was going to say, presumably they're more concentrated because it's so capital intensive to develop the mine. So you said they have like six prospects?
Yeah. Where's the money they raise? Probably can only focus on. In contrary to us, we try to be much more scalable. We're helping with discovering deposits and then handing the project 100% to our partners, which have the all incentive because it's 100% owned by them to develop it further. We just take the royalty clip of the revenue.
And then you move on to the next.
Exactly. So for us to run the full campaign of 200 projects costs us $10.5 million.
Okay.
Versus 250 million.
Yeah, pretty capital efficient. Even if it means you have a smaller percentage of the royalty down the road, you're more diversified and more capital efficient.
Yeah, but the problem is when the success rate is so low, I believe it's more important to be as scalable as possible.
Yeah, the whole reason we invest in multiple companies.
Yeah.
And then what's Stratum AI up to?
Stratum AI is helping exploration companies through the feasibility phase. And the mining companies during production. So they're kind of the next stage after what we do. When you have discovery, you're estimating the resource, you're drilling it out, you're seeing how valuable the ore body is going to be. Even when you're mining, you want to maximize your efficiency of, like, you want to mine the highest grade ore to kind of have the biggest profit margin. So they're optimizing the resource using sort of three-dimensional AI technology to kind of be better at mapping out the ore body and predicting where to dig.
Cool. So very complimentary to what you're doing.
Yeah, totally.
Before we let you go, I'm curious to know if everything goes right, you raise all the capital you need to, what's like your dream for Earth AI in 10, 20 years?
Yeah. So say 10 years, find the majority of the future critical metal deposits and own a stake in each of them to become the biggest mining company in the world. And 20 years, explore other planets, look for metals, look for natural wonders.
So our closing question for all our guests is, when, if Earth AI makes you a billionaire, what do you think you're going to do with the money? Other than mine, other planets.
I don't know. I just keep doing what I'm doing.
Yeah, that's what most of the founders we invest in say. You'll be mining asteroids and other planets.
If it's company money, then yeah, we'll fully automate everything and just have like an automated machines running exploration and finding deposits and mining them out.
So when you're the biggest mining company in the world, you do want to extract as well. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, because there's one problem in finding them. The second problem, like, which is equally important, is extracting them efficiently, like as minimally invasive as possible. Because like when you think about this, like these concentrations, like highly concentrated chemical elements, you know, if they're in shallow depths, they're not great for biosphere either. You know, you want to ideally remove these highly concentrated metals, put back the original rock so it doesn't. So the part of why we find these deposits is because the groundwater circulate and that high copper gets moved around and kind of pop up at the surface at the end. It can contaminate the water, the soil, the rock. So if we go and remove it, it's actually, you know, the normal levels of chemicals return back to normal. So it's not actually bad to the environment to remove the mineral deposits because they're like unnaturally too rich in chemicals. But, you know, doing so in a most minimally invasive way and also extract as much as possible from them is really important.
I've never thought of it that way. You're like cleaning up the ecosystem's waste, which just so happens to be incredibly valuable to humans.
Or just any, you know, live things. Bacteria, I think, as well.
Yeah. Well, Roman, thanks so much for joining us. This has been a lot of fun. We'll have to have you on in a couple of years, and we'll check back in on where Earth AI is and how close you are to being the biggest mining company in the solar system.
Yeah, we'll Skype from Mars. Might be a little delayed.
Yeah, we'll have to wait.
How big is the delay?
8 minutes, I think. Well, it depends on where we are in relation to Mars. On average, 8 minutes, I think.
Yeah, good. We don't do these live. That'd be a bit of a...
Yeah, we'd have to just pre-script it out. We'll cross that bridge when we get to it.
Just like, let's wait until Roman replies.
Roman, thanks for joining us.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Near Frontier. Links to external content mentioned are available in the show notes and at nearfrontier.com, where you can also find other episodes of the show. To leave feedback or suggest future guests, you can find us on Twitter @Kantos.